hear the first case for this morning, 003195, Tri-Tech Corporation versus AmeriCom Services, Inc. Attorney Hansen, representing James Schmidt, will speak first for 25 minutes, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Attorney Dayton Hansen, and I represent the petitioner, James Schmidt. I think it will help perspective on this to go back in time to the critical date, and that would be the date of the summary judgment hearing, and look at the matter from the attorney's perspective as that date. Now, Tri-Tech had filed a complaint against a corporation, AmeriComp, which was a computer company, and against Schmidt as the owner and officer of AmeriComp. AmeriComp and Schmidt had filed an answer denying certain factual issues, and it had filed an amended answer asserting certain set-off rights of AmeriComp. AmeriComp essentially admitted that it owed the money. It was an account. AmeriComp owed the money. The question is, Schmidt owed the money? And both AmeriComp and Schmidt disputed at all times that this was a contractor theft case. Now, the answer and the amended answer denied that the France Group, that's the company who AmeriComp was doing business with, was an owner of the property, as that word is defined, and it denied, among other things, that there had been any improvements made to property, as that word is defined in the construction contract statutes. In addition, Schmidt had filed an affidavit as an independent document denying that the France Group was the owner of the property and denying that there were improvements made to the property. Now, at the hearing for summary judgment against the AmeriComp
Council, as I understand it, there were two summary judgments.
Right.
Which one are you referring to?
Right now, we're proceeding to the summary judgment against AmeriComp.
Oh, okay.
The second one is where I started, and right now in my time chronology, I'm proceeding to the first one. But there was a hearing for summary judgment against AmeriComp, and at that hearing, AmeriComp effectively agreed that it owed the money. The plaintiff, Tri-Tech, agreed to the set-off amount asserted in the amended answer, and there was a judgment entered against AmeriComp on the account stated cause of action. The contractor theft cause of action was dismissed in the order on that for summary judgment, and there were no treble damages awarded against AmeriComp. Now, after that hearing was concluded, Tri-Tech filed a motion for summary judgment against Schmidt. And in conjunction, the only evidence offered by Tri-Tech was that it attached some interrogatories that had been submitted by Schmidt to Tri-Tech. Well, response to interrogatories signed by Schmidt. Now, these responses to interrogatories denied, one, that the France Group was the owner of the property, and denied there had been any permanent improvements made to the property. They also had an invoice attached that was sent by AmeriComp to the France Group. That was the only evidence before the court at the hearing on the summary judgment, other than the
affidavit. Schmidt had denied all the allegations of Tri-Tech's complaint, right?
Not all the allegations, but yes, the ones as
with
to
respect to ownership and respect to improvements.
Right. Denied it in the answer, denied it in the interrogatories, denied it in the affidavit filed by Schmidt.
And that was a denial by Schmidt, not just AmeriCorps.
Right, that's correct. It was denial by Schmidt in the answer, the interrogatories were signed by Schmidt, and the affidavit was one of James Schmidt. That became an issue later on because the Court of Appeals said the affidavit was filed solely in the context for the motion for summary judgment against AmeriComp. Indeed, that affidavit was additionally attached to a brief filed to the motion for AmeriComp, but it was also filed as an independent document.
Counsel, assist me. Do you know where in the appendix, I see appendix 163 at page 163, is for the second summary judgment motion?
This second?
The brief in support of motion for summary judgment.
By Tri-Tech?
By the respondent.
that is attached, I know where it is.
First.
With respect to the respondents.
Okay.
Brief.
It's by Tri-Tech. What I'm getting at is this. Where are the answers to the interrogatories?
The answers to interrogatories are attached as an exhibit to the second motion for summary judgment filed by Tri-Tech.
And do you know
they were offered by Tri-Tech, not by us. I believe that's number 9. It looks like it's 163 of their appendix.
Okay, that's what I was looking at. I just need help with this. 163 is okay, in the red brief.
Right, maybe they're not.
That is the brief in support of the motion for summary judgment. And attached to that brief in support of the motion for summary judgment is an invoice.
Right.
Okay. Now, where are the answers to the interrogatories that you're referring to?
173. Excuse me, 174. Okay. 175. We're getting there. Sorry about that.
Okay. Thank you. Were these... these appended to any affidavit?
No. As far as I know, they were not filed with the court in any other means other than being appended to the brief as an exhibit filed by Tri-Tech.
Okay. So at the second summary judgment motion hearing, no affidavit was filed by Schmidt specifically for the second summary judgment hearing. Is that correct? I don't mean this is a trick question.
Okay. Schmidt had
filed one in the first hearing. Argument is that affidavit carries over to the second hearing, and the Court of Appeals said no.
Right. I had filed the affidavit for the first hearing. Okay. I looked at my file, and I said, do I need to file another affidavit? I said, no.
Yeah. Okay. My question is, did Tri-Tech file any affidavit for the second hearing?
No, did not.
So what are they relying on to support their summary judgment motion?
That was my argument, Your Honor. I agree with you. I don't think there's anything that there was no evidence of record to support their summary judgment motion.
They need more than the complaint.
More than the complaint.
Does the defendant's response to interrogatories suffice for what would normally be a plaintiff's affidavit in support of the motion? The Court of Appeals opinion doesn't deal with this at all.
If Schmidt had admitted the ownership issue, or if Schmidt had admitted the improvements issue in the response to discovery, yeah, I think that could have been offered as evidence. Certainly discovery is admissible evidence in the case. But in this circumstance, instead of admitting it, is one more denial of those issues. He denied it was a construction contract, denied the ownership issue, and denied the improvements issue.
Mr. Hansen, let me ask you a couple of things. Were there different judges involved in these two summary judgment motions?
Yes, there were.
That's what I thought. And also, at the second summary judgment motion hearing, did you make any mention of the fact that the affidavit had been filed in regard to the first summary judgment motion? Is there any reference to Mr. Schmidt's affidavit?
Yes, there is, Your Honor, in that hearing. Unfortunately, I did not argue the second summary judgment hearing.
Someone else did.
Yeah, I was at a trial in federal court that
day. But the court's attention was directed toward that affidavit?
Yes, Your Honor, that affidavit was referenced by the attorney arguing the case.
Is this all in one case file? It looks to me there's one case number, and then when the summary judgment was against Americom, they just continued it, and the judge got the whole file.
Right, that's correct, Your Honor, it's just one case.
You treated it like one, right?
In fact, there was just one answer filed by Schmidt and Americomp, I believe. It's all one lawsuit.
But you didn't file again?
Right.
And so it's all in the court file?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's just assume for the moment that we would accept that view, that it's all there, and that the court, trial court, has to look at the whole, everything. We still have two issues. One are the legal issues, namely, which really don't depend on the facts, but whether treble damages are allowed in this kind of lawsuit, and what is the relationship among the three statutes, right? That's one main legal issue with many subdivisions, right? The second legal issue that we have is, let's assume you lose on all the other legal issues and your client is liable for treble damages. Might be liable for treble damages. You have the issues of whether you get a trial or this is a summary judgment issue. Is that correct?
Right.
So before we get to the legal issue, let's just discuss, if you can, for a few minutes, why you don't think summary judgment can be granted and why you think you should get a trial should you lose on the questions of law.
Okay.
If you don't think I've stated this correctly or have misstated what's at issue, you ought to say that so we don't spend a lot of time.
Okay. Coming back to the summary judgment, then let's just look at the facts. The trial court proceeded and attempted basically to try to determine the improvements issue, which I think was an issue of fact, whether or not computer cabling constitutes an improvement. And basically he looked at it and said, it sounds like electrical wiring, so I'm going to find this an improvement. The Court of Appeals reviewed that and found that wasn't an issue of fact, whether computer cabling is an improvement as a matter of law, and found as a matter of law, computer cabling is an improvement to property. Now, I have a network in my office. I've got my law clerk's computer on one end of the room and my computer on the other end of the room. And there's a little wire that looks kind of like an extension cord, and it's plugged into my law clerk's computer, and it runs along the wall. It's not attached to the wall. It's kind of kicked underneath the radiator. Now, there's a little box about the size of a clock radio that is a hub that's plugged into an electrical outlet. Otherwise, it's not affixed to the building. And there's a wire running from that hub to my computer. Nothing is affixed to the building other than where they're plugged into the electrical outlets.
Did this cost you $27,000?
No, but it cost several hundred dollars. And I had planned on taking it with me when I left. But that goes more to the point. Because if I leave the building that I'm in, if I'm going to take a $200 cable and hub, if you were leaving a building as a tenant and you had $17,000 of wire sitting there, wouldn't you want to take as much of that with you as you could because you can reuse it? That is an issue of fact, Your Honors.
Well, first of all, don't we have to know much more about what we're talking about, how many wires they are, whether they're affixed, do they run under the concrete floor, do they run through the fake ceiling? I mean, are any of those facts in the record?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
And you did. And Schmidt denied. Did Schmidt actually deny that these were improvements?
Yes, he did.
What document?
In the answer, in the interrogatories, and in his affidavit.
Is the affidavit in the first Americomp?
Right.
What's another issue of fact? We don't need too many. We just need
a few. The other one is the ownership issue. Okay. And that's whether the France Group was the owner of the property. In order to be an owner of the property, you have to be an ownership interest in property and enter into a contract for the improvement of property. That's a defined term in the statute, what an owner is for the construction statutes. And in this case, there's no evidence that, one, the France Group was the owner of the property. They say because there's an invoice sent to the France Group and an address, that establishes ownership under the statute. But the ownership talks about somebody entering into a contract for the improvement of property.
Can you be a tenant and be an owner? Can you be a tenant and be an owner?
You can be a tenant and being owner if you have entered into a contract for the impermanent improvement of property. But there's a presumption that as a tenant, if I'm doing things to my property, that it's temporary, that it's not intended to be a permanent improvement.
Right, so that there are interrelated issues, maybe, improvement and ownership.
Yes, I agree.
Okay. Are there any other fact issues?
No, Your Honor, I believe those were the fact issues in the case.
And Schmidt, in his answer, denied ownership?
Yes, he did. That the France Group was the owner.
Then how can you give me any rationale supporting the Court of Appeals decision that you waived this issue?
That waived that issue?
Yeah.
What happened was the attorney who argued the case didn't argue at the summary judgment hearing the ownership issue. It had been raised in the answer, in the affidavit, in the interrogatories, but he didn't argue it at the hearing, and so the Court of Appeals determined that he had waived it, didn't cite any legal authority for that proposition, and really if you apply the summary judgment methodology, which requires you to look at the complaint, look at the answer, and determine if there are any issues or joined, and then if the issue is joined, look to see if there's evidence submitted by the plaintiff. If he had followed that methodology, in later records, the court could review that decision, then he would have had to address the ownership issue. So it can't be waived merely by not arguing it at the hearing.
If you are completed with the concept that this was not a case that should have been handled on summary judgment, let us move, if you're willing, to the legal issues.
Okay. That basically is a different issue at the trial court level than at the Court of Appeals level, but we'll start at the trial court level. There is a statute that awards treble damages for intentional conduct in violation of certain statutes, and it lists a number of different statutes to which it is applicable, and that statute is 895.80. One of the statutes that's not listed is the theft by contractor statute. That is not listed as one of the statutes to treble damages apply. The trial court found that even though theft by contractor statute is not listed specifically in the theft by contract in the treble damages statute, that it was going to award treble damages anyway. And the way it got there is that the theft by contractor statute, that's 779.02 sub 5, indicates that it's punishable under the criminal theft statute. The criminal theft statute has three parts. The first part is it lists various types of conduct that would constitute criminal theft. And then it has a part two, which has a definition section. And then it has a part three, which is a penalty section, which has various penalties that can be imposed if you have violated the criminal theft statute. And he said, because it's punishable under theft, therefore, I am going to make the treble damage statute apply to the theft by contractor statute. However, there are rules of construction of the statutes. First of all, the treble damages statute is not ambiguous, so the plain language in the statute controls. Second, treble damages statutes are punitive, so they must be narrowly construed. And third, when you have a statute that lists a number of different statutes to which it applies, if in enacting the statute they had meant it to apply to more statutes, such as the theft by contractor statute, it would have been easy to insert that statute into the list, but it wasn't. So we have to presume that that wasn't an omission, that it was intentional. Now, the Court of Appeals agreed with us in this argument. It found that the treble damages statute does not apply to the theft by contractor statute. But it went one step further. It made a giant leap here, and it found that Schmidt had the intent to commit criminal theft. But if you remember on the summary judgment argument, there's no evidence of any intent on the part of Schmidt. The Court of Appeals apparently got confused as to the corporation and Schmidt and uses the terms interchangeably. forgot that the theft by contractor claim against AmeriComp had been dismissed, and basically didn't review the fact issue of the intent. For instance, AmeriComp is a computer company. This isn't a case that involves construction draws. It's not the typical construction case. There are no houses being built. In fact, Tritech didn't provide any lien notices. Now, do you have to file lien notices to avail yourself of the construction statute? No. But if you're going to talk about intent on the part of somebody who owns a computer company or an officer of a computer company, then they should at least be on notice that somebody considers this contract to be in the nature of a construction contract. But there's no evidence that that was ever discussed, and it appears more that the lawsuit or theft by contractor issues are more of a collection device than actually in dealing with what the parties dealt with in the nature of a construction contract. There was no trust fund. There were no draws. There was nothing to show that this contract was other than a typical accounts receivable between vendors. Now, Tritech has started a six-part test, and that test is in Hess. And that test is the one that the courts have come up with since this court's ruling in Blaisdell to determine whether somebody has committed criminal theft by contractor. And the six-part test comes down, and the first element is the defendant acts as a prime contractor. Once again, we know that's a defined term. Two, defendant received money for the improvement of land from the owner or a mortgagee. We run into the summary judgment issues there again as to owner and as to improvement. Three, defendant...
Counsel, could you speak up? I'm having a little difficulty here.
I'm sorry. I'll try to work on that. The defendant intentionally used the money for purposes other than payment of bona fide claims for labor or materials prior to the payment of such claims. Four, the use was without the owner or mortgagee's consent and contrary to the defendant's authority. And five, this is one of the key issues, the defendant knew the use was without consent and contrary to his authority. And then there's a sixth one. The defendant used the money with the intent to convert to his own use or the use of another. Now,
you're reading the elements of what?
Those are the elements cited by Tritech as the elements of criminal theft by contractor.
943.20.
Well, that's basically what the case law is developed as to what elements are required following this court's decision in Blaisdell.
Under 943.20?
Yes.
These are the elements of the crime?
Right.
Okay. The criminal jury instructions set forth four elements, and I just wasn't tracking them as you were reading your six. How does that comport?
Okay, I'm sorry. I basically lifted those from the brief filed by Tritech. Those are elements set forth in the Hess case as six elements, and that's what Tritech is using as the six elements. Now, Tritech did not introduce any evidence of intent. It tries to bootstrap the intent argument because there's a presumption in the criminal theft statute, and under that presumption that if there's a demand made for the return of property and you refuse to return it, there's a presumption that meets the sixth element of that test, that you had the intent to own or use for another.
Now, counsel, in order to be entitled to treble damages under 895.80, what elements have to be shown? The elements of 779.02 or the elements of 943.20? What has to be proven?
I believe you have to prove 943.20. You know, if you want treble damages, you have to, one, the treble damages statute itself says intentional conduct in violation of one of the listed statutes. So there's an intention requirement there, and then the theft statute itself requires intentional conduct. I think you need intentional at both levels of the theft statute, the criminal theft statute, and you need the intent requirement under the treble damages statute. I do not believe, I agree with the Court of Appeals, at least to the extent that a mere violation of the theft by contractor statute does not lead to treble damages. You have to have actual criminal theft in order for there to be treble damages.
And the elements, if you look at 943.20 and 779.02, the elements are not the same.
That's correct.
And so I want to know what set of elements have to be established, and then we'll take a look at the record to see if a prima facie showing has been made sufficient for summary judgment. So what are we looking at? Are we looking at 779.02 plus intent, or are we looking at 943.20?
I think you have to look at 943.20 and in the intent requirement there. And under that requirement, I believe implicit in that requirement under 943 is that the defendant had to have criminal intent. There has to be some type of malice involved. That intent would be that the defendant knew the use was without consent and contrary to his authority. Somebody cannot commit a crime under these circumstances unless he had knowledge that what he was doing was somehow not correct. If there was a construction contract, and then we might get to that type of knowledge. But you're dealing with a company that's really a computer company. There's no construction contract, no construction draws, and no evidence of any intent on Schmidt, much less any wrongful intent.
Counsel, your first issue is that 779 doesn't apply at all.
Right.
Right. And therefore, at least if you can establish that there was lack of ownership or lack of improvements, and therefore this was inappropriate for summary judgment.
Right.
So what if we agree with you? What if we agree that summary judgment was inappropriately granted here? Do we even reach the second issue of the applicability of treble damages?
Probably not.
Well,
I mean, it'd be nice to have a decision because it would be helpful in the construction industry, but in terms of this case, no, it's not.
But this might go back for trial, right?
Yes.
So at trial, these same legal issues are going to arise, aren't they?
Yeah, I believe so.
So usually, if that's true, the same legal issues are likely to arise, then we're back into a position where the Court of Appeals decision on those issues will govern, which is not what you're interested in.
It would be our preference.
You come back again.
It would be our preference the court decides the issue here, Your Honor.
So that when it goes back to trial,
we know what issues are to be tried.
Your red light is...
I see that, Your Honor.
Counsel, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Wilson-Beck, representing Tri-Tech Corporation of America.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert Wilson-Beck, and I represent the respondent plaintiff, Tri-Tech Corporation of America. As the court knows, there are really three main issues that came to us on appeal from Court of Appeals District 2, and those are... First, the legal issue, whether Section 89580 encompasses a violation of 779.02 sub 5, the theft by contractor statute, through Section 943.20, the theft statute. Second issue is whether computer cabling can constitute a permanent improvement to property. And the last one is whether the plaintiff provided prima facie evidence of ownership and whether a tenant is an owner of an interest in land. I'll start first with the Section 895 argument. Schmidt argues that 895 does not apply to theft by contractor because it is not specifically listed within 89580. However, 89580 does state that anyone who suffers loss by intentional conduct under 943.20 has a cause of action civilly and may recover treble damages. 943.20 does encompass the crime of theft by contractor. Under 779.02 sub 5, a prime contractor must hold funds in trust for the benefit of his subcontractors. The prime contractor has to pay all the claims of the subcontractors or all the claims proportionally if there is a shortfall. Under 779.02, that prime contractor must hold those funds in trust for the benefit of their subcontractors, and they cannot pay themselves until all the subcontractors have been paid. So that establishes a trust for the benefit of the subcontractors and a duty on behalf of the prime contractor.
Well, are all of these, are any of these issues involved here, as a matter of fact? Is there any problem? Are we sure that this is a contractor? Are we sure that this is a subcontractor? Are we, is that in debate?
I don't think that was ever debated. It was clear through the pleadings that Mr. Schmidt and AmeriComp had hired Tritech to actually install the cabling. Tritech provided all of the materials, the cabling, and the labor. And Mr. Schmidt and AmeriComp are the ones who actually received the funds. So it was never disputed that they were a prime contractor or subcontractor. The only issues really raised through the pleadings or through the affidavits were the issues of ownership and improvement.
What did Tritech put in on this second summary judgment?
Tritech had provided a brief with the attached interrogatories. The reason we had to do additional discovery was to show that Schmidt had not used all the funds to pay his subcontractors. Only by showing that were we able to prove that he violated both 779.02 and 943.20. If a party can establish that not all of the subcontractors have been paid and that the prime contractor has used that money for himself, then you can establish a violation of both 779.02 and 943.20.
Counsel, as I look at the response to discovery interrogatories that are attached at page 175 of the exhibit, what you have in that attachment are the interrogatory answers and then a response for demand for production. I don't think the demand for production is relevant here, but correct me if I'm wrong. And then looking at the defendant's response to discovery, the first question has a response that raises the issue whether or not this work constituted improvements. I mean, it says no money was received from the France group relating to materials and services provided for construction or improvements. Would you agree or disagree with me that that raises a question, that raises a question as to whether or not any money was received for improvements to the property?
Well, I think based on the case law, that doesn't raise an issue. All that's required under Wisconsin law for a subcontractor to have a lien right is that the materials are delivered to the property. There's also other case law which describes what type of lien interest you can have, and they've been granted for such things as draft tubes which haven't been attached to the property, or for electrical switches for furnaces which are owned by a tenant. So it was clear before filing for the summary judgment that all we needed to prove was that the cabling was actually delivered to the property, and it wasn't even disputed that it was actually installed into the property or that the cable itself is permanent. So as to the improvements, I don't think there was an issue there.
The response of no money was received from the France group relating to materials and services provided for construction. Does that raise an issue?
I'm sorry.
Just the first part of that response. No money was received from the France group relating to materials and services provided for construction. Does that raise an issue of fact?
I don't think it raises any issue of fact. I think there was clearly no dispute that the computer cable was actually delivered and installed. It was also stated on the invoice that this was for new construction. And they go on to state further that the amount was just paid by the France Group for computer cabling. So I don't think there was ever any factual issue raised by the defendant that this wasn't an improvement. He simply just denies. He denies in his answer, he denies in his affidavit, and in the brief that it's not an improvement. He doesn't go anything more to say this isn't a permanent improvement because it's only going to last for a year or that it's going to be removed by the tenant under some plan or anything. He just simply offers a mere denial. And I think that's an issue
Why isn't that enough?
I think under the summary judgment standards, under 802.08, he was required to prove or introduce some specific evidentiary materials to oppose the motion for summary judgment. He didn't do that. He could have simply filed an affidavit stating that the tenant told me they're going to remove this within 3 years. He's the one who contracted with the France Group. Tritec didn't enter this contract. They had no idea if there was some type of a plan to remove this.
Where's your proof? I mean, you have the burden as the plaintiff to show all of these elements. Where do you do that except in your complaint? And in a summary judgment, don't you need more than the complaint?
As to the issue of improvements?
Issue of improvements, issue as to subcontract, issue as to, ownership.
Well, again, I think as to improvements, as I stated, the case law makes it clear that materials...
Yeah, where do you describe, factually describe, what your... You did the work, right? Your client did the work.
Correct.
Where do you describe that?
Describe the actual...
Yeah.
Well, it's in the pleadings that it just basically states that the computer cabling was installed to the property. And there's no denial of that through the answer. He's just denying that it's permanent. His argument is basically that it can be removed. He doesn't offer any evidence as to that it will be removed or how it could be removed or why it would be removed, but he says it can be removed and therefore it's not permanent. And if that's the case, if that's what the court wants to establish as case law, then anyone could make that argument for any type of an improvement to property. You could remove electrical wiring, you can remove plumbing, you can do anything. If that's what the court is going to decide, that's going to disrupt all the subcontractors who provide materials and services to tenants of commercial buildings. Who knows how long they're going to be in there?
Well, the question is not whether we should decide that as an issue of law, as the Court of Appeals apparently did, but whether it's a question of fact and the facts are in dispute. So the Court of Appeals decided the issue apparently as a question of law. And the defendant maintains that this is a question of fact and that you didn't put in enough facts to make a prima facie case that this was an improvement as that term is defined in the statute, and so that he didn't have to come forward with anything more than simply the denial that it was an improvement.
Right.
Your opposing counsel described in his office what the cables were, and then you said, well, this would apply to any electrical wiring. I think there obviously is a difference between the electrical wiring put in this building, what we're talking about, the computer cables, things of that nature. I think that's what some of the colleagues on this court are talking about, that we know nothing about that. We don't really know what was involved.
I guess I don't see any difference between computer cabling or telephone wiring or electrical wiring. I think it's clear that if you deliver those materials to the property, that you're granted a lien right on it.
Well, this case isn't about lien rights, though. It's about an impressed trust pursuant to a statute which has a number of defined terms, and whether what occurred here is criminal for purposes of the treble damages statute. So
right,
the lien rights issue is not relevant.
Well, it would be relevant as to the issue of you're not able to be granted lien rights unless you satisfy the elements of 779.02, which includes ownership and improvements. So if we're granting lien rights to individuals who deliver materials to the property that aren't even installed into the property, and they're granted lien rights, we're assuming we're granting them that it is an improvement and that it is permanent and that it's for the owner. And here we've done even more than that. We've actually provided the materials, we've installed it, and it's into the property. So,
do you agree that you had to prove, or at least present a prima facie case on your motion for summary judgment under 943.20 in order to recover under 895.80?
Yes, you have to prove a prima facie case, and I think, as was discussed earlier, I think the elements for that, if you look at the case law, State v. Hess, I think those elements really track 779.02 with an additional element that you need intent to convert. And if you look to section 943.20, I think actually the elements to be proved under that are less than what's under 779.02. All you would have to prove under 943.20 is that a prime contractor or an individual, by virtue of his or her office, business or employment, or as a trustee, having possession or custody of money, intentionally uses, transfers, conceals, or retains such possession of money without the owner's consent, contrary to his authority, and with intent to convert it to his or her own use. And then it goes on to state that a refusal to deliver any money which is in his or her possession, or by custody, or custody by virtue of his or her office, business, employment, or as trustee, upon demand, is prima facie evidence of an intent to convert it. So if you can prove the elements under 779.02, you can show that the money was not actually paid to the subcontractors, or that it was used for some purpose other than to pay the subcontractors, you've then shown that there is an intent to convert based on this presumption under 943.20.
Counsel, I'm missing the elements of something important to me here. I have before me the jury instruction on 943.20.1b. And the fourth element, for instance, there it sets forth four. I'm not saying this is correct or incorrect. I'm saying this is what's before me, so I'm using this as the basis for questioning. It says the fourth element requires that the defendant used the money with intent to convert it to his own use. As used here, the phrase intent to convert to his own use means the defendant must have had the mental purpose to use, appropriate, or convert such property to his own personal use. Now, where in the record have you established a prima facie showing to meet that element?
Well, it was clear from his answers to interrogatories that the money which he received...
Okay, what answer?
Answer number two, if you look...
What page?
I believe it's page 175 of the respondent's brief. We ask the question, please identify all disbursements or payments made by defendants from the monies received from the France Group. The response was that the money received from the France Group was placed into the business manager account at Port Washington State Bank. Port Washington State Bank had an assignment of that receivable, and it also had a general business security agreement encumbering all of the assets of America, including the accounts receivable. So that establishes that Mr. Schmidt, first of all, knew that the bank had a general business security agreement encumbering all the assets. Second, he went even farther and admitted that they had an assignment of that receivable. So what you have is Mr. Schmidt hiring Tritech, assigning his interest in all of those monies received to the bank, getting the money, and giving it to the bank, knowing full well that Tritech wasn't going to be paid.
Well, maybe that assignment preceded to the contract with Tritech.
Well, if
do
that's...
Do you know that?
I don't know that, but if that's the case, then it would be further evidence that he hired Tritech fully knowing that and not intending to pay them.
Well, it seems to me you have a fight between two creditors, your client, Tritech, and the Port Washington State Bank. And there may be a question as to whether the bank that has a general business security agreement takes precedence over a contract lien. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. It's been a long time since I did any of this. But there may be an answer. There may not be an answer. But I don't think you can say because there is a general business security agreement encumbering the assets that that's an intent to defraud Tritech.
Well, clearly Mr. Schmidt knew that the assets were going to be taken by the bank. And in his brief, he argues, had he known he would have been personally responsible, he would have asked the bank for an exception so that he could have paid Tritech. And I think that shows that he knew the money was never going to be paid to Tritech.
Look, do they pay I assume that AmeriCom pays rent if they don't own their property, or they pay property taxes, and they pay gas and electric bills, right? And telephone bills. They've got to take all that money out of receivables, right?
Correct.
And so Port Washington Bank allows that under the agreement, right? I don't know what the agreement is. Is this in the record?
The agreement between AmeriComp and the bank?
Yes.
I don't think there's any evidence of that.
So, I mean, there are payouts. 100% of the accounts receivable just doesn't go to the bank. There are payouts made, right?
From France Group? Or from the bank?
There are payouts made by AmeriComp, right? From their receivables, and that are not tied up by the bank, right?
I would assume so.
That's right. So saying all of this does not necessarily, to me anyway, show that his intent here is to convert.
Well, I think if you look at State versus Blaisdell, there's a discussion in there of whether prime contractor uses that receivable to pay his normal business debts. And it states that's still clearly a violation, that he's under the obligation of first pay all the subcontractors, and whether he used that for a good faith purpose to pay his business debts or his rent or his phone or whatever it may be, it's still a violation of that section. He has to pay his subcontractors first. So whether he owed money to the bank or owed rent, that's not an issue as far as we're concerned. He was under an obligation to pay the subcontractors first and then himself.
Well, I think that driving it, if the money was placed in this account, what you're saying is that if the money was received, it had to be paid over right away. My question was this business account a checking account? Is this where he placed it so that he could pay? In other words, by placing the money in this account, did he have other accounts? Could he have placed that money in other accounts in order to pay Tritech? Question, and that's not answered.
And that's something we didn't feel that we needed to get into on summary judgment. All we had to show was that he received the money, failed to pay the subcontractors. It was his obligation to pay the subcontractors, whether he put that into a general business account or another account that wasn't encumbered, that was still his duty to get it into the hands of the subcontractor. And he admits here that he knew the account was encumbered and had an assignment of it. So it was never going to get to the France Group or to Tritech.
One of the differences between theft by con... and 943.20 is, for instance, the first element of theft by contractor, which says the first element requires that the defendant enter into an oral or written agreement for labor or materials to improve land. Now, you are arguing that you're proceeding under 943.20, where you really just have to show that they received the money. Is that correct?
Well, I think our argument was...
Or had possession of the money.
Right, and our argument was, I think, both that once you prove a violation of 779.02, with the intent to convert, you have proven a violation of 943.20.
Say that again, once you have received the money.
Well, if you can prove a violation under these six elements established by the case law to prove theft by contractor under 779.02, you've also proven that that is a violation of 943.20. And that's how, if you prove those elements, you've established a violation of the criminal theft statute, 943.20. If you can prove conduct violates that, you're entitled to have the treble damages under 895.80. It would be the same thing as if you just filed a complaint and alleged that someone was holding money in trust and that they failed to pay the money over under 943.20. We've gone farther here and we've alleged and shown all of the elements under the theft by contractor statute.
Do you need to, in showing unlawful conversion, from the fourth element requires the defendant use the money with intent to convert it to his own purpose. Do you need to show what the agreement provided initially? In other words, just because I have money doesn't mean that I intended to convert it just because I possess it. But perhaps if I have a written or oral agreement that says, as soon as you get the money, give it to me and don't put it anyplace else. I mean, don't you need more than just having the money? You need the underlying reason why you have the money and any kind of agreement that may have been arranged by the parties?
Well, I think under 779 or under Chapter 779, the duty arises from that. It's not a contractual duty. It's a duty established by the statutes. The statutes provide that if a prime contractor receives that money, he must hold it in trust for the benefit of the subcontractors.
Maybe. I don't know that. I just know that the jury instruction on 779 says the first element requires the defendant entered into an oral or written agreement for labor and materials to improve the land.
And that would be the agreement here to provide the materials and the services, which was done. They provided the materials at the request of Mayor Kampf and Mr. Schmidt, and those were all allegations that were stated in the complaint and I think answered without any sort of a denial. So there wasn't any issue as to whether they had reached an agreement. He never raised any issues that this was supposed to be paid under some other type of a scheme, and clearly he was under the duty to pay it under 779.
Counsel, you're here, and I gather you support the Court of Appeals decision.
Yes.
Is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision that you would change?
Not that I can recall. I think they had followed our arguments. Basically, the only difference they had come to was that in order to prove a theft by contractor, you were required to prove some type of a criminal intent. I don't think in order to recover under 895-80 you have to prove criminal intent per se. I think what you have to prove is that they use the money for a purpose other than to pay their subcontractors. And then if you can show that, then you also use the presumption under 943-20 that a refusal to pay those over is prima facie evidence of their intent to convert.
And then the Court of Appeals inferred this criminal intent from this record. Is that it?
That's correct. And basically,
is that the only reasonable inference that can be made?
Well, I think under 779-02, if you don't pay all the subcontractors and you have shown that the prime contractor has used that for any other purpose, especially here where he's used it for his own benefit to pay off his creditor, and with the presumption under 943-20, I think that is prima facie evidence that he did have intent to convert, and it remained unrebutted by the defendant. He never offered any evidence to say, as the trial court said, if he would have said, I deposited into the wrong account or I wrote the wrong account number on it, that may have been a defense. Or it could have been a defense had he raised some issues saying that there was a bona fide dispute here. That's one of the defenses under 779-02, that there's a bona fide dispute. And he didn't do any of that. So really the presumption remained unrebutted by him.
Perhaps it would be helpful to go element by element under the elements of this cause of action for treble damages for theft by contractor as stated in the Hess case. And if you could point to the evidence that's in the record pertaining to Mr. Schmidt's liability for each of these elements. The first one is that the defendant, Mr. Schmidt, in this case, acted as a prime contractor.
And for that, I think the pleadings, the complaint alleged that they hired Tritech to do the work, and I think that was not denied in that answer.
Is it alleged that Mr. Schmidt did that?
It was alleged in the complaint that Mr. Schmidt was the sole owner, shareholder, and president of AmeriComp.
Do we have any issues here about the corporation versus Mr. Schmidt?
I guess the only issue would be whether an individual can be held responsible under 895-80. And clearly, if you look at 779-02, it states in sub 5 there that if it's theft by a corporation, the officers, directors are deemed to be responsible for that misappropriation.
Okay. The second element is that the defendant, Mr. Schmidt, received money for the improvement of land from the owner or a mortgagee.
And I think that's another element that was alleged in the complaint and wasn't denied. And it was further shown if you look...
It was denied that the defendant, whether that's construed to be Mr. Schmidt or Tri-Tech or both under 779, I thought it was denied that he or they received money for the improvement of land as that term is defined in the statute from an owner as that term is defined in the statute.
I guess as to whether it was an improvement, that actual term was denied.
So there was a dispute of fact as to those two aspects of the second element as stated in the Hess case.
Well, I don't think there was a dispute of fact. As I stated, the cabling was actually delivered to the property. It was actually installed, and under the case law, that is considered to be all that is needed to have the lien rights. And once the courts recognize that a lien right has been granted for that, you've established the other elements, that it is a permanent improvement.
What about the ownership issue?
Well, as to ownership, Mr. Schmidt and AmeriComp denied in their answer and in their brief and affidavit for the first hearing that he wasn't the owner, basically in fee simple, of the entire property. And if you look at 779-01, that states in there that an owner can be a tenant. Also, the legislative council notes state that an owner can be a tenant, as well as Professor Rauschenbusch recognizes that a tenant can have an ownership interest in the land, and that interest is lienable. So the difference between ownership of the entire building or being a tenant may come in if the subcontractor would want to foreclose on the whole property. Then you would have issues of agency, whether the tenant is acting as an agent of the owner. But if the materials are provided to the tenant, his lease is a lienable interest.
Right, and all that may be true, but the point was none of that was ever litigated here. It was denied. You never came forward on your summary judgment motion with affirmative evidence to establish a prima facie case on the ownership issue.
Well, I think a prima facie case was made through the pleadings, through the answers to interrogatories. There was no dispute that he had an interest in land or that that the France Group didn't have a right to contract for the improvements of the land. Yes, it's true we didn't say introduce a deed or something of that nature to say he is the owner of the land.
What was your prima facie case on that issue?
Well, you have the agreement between the parties. You have the evidence that the computer cabling was installed to that location. You have the invoices which show the invoices were sent to that location for the France Group.
Did any of those documents describe what the ownership interest of the France Group was?
I don't believe any of those actually define what the interest was in the land.
Open question. We still don't know, looking at this record.
We don't know what exactly the interest is.
So it wasn't litigated.
Well, I think it's clear that they had an interest in the land. There's no dispute that they were able to contract for the improvements. They contracted to have these improvements put into the land, and I don't think it's a good faith argument that you can say that they don't have an interest in this land if they're contracting to put in these type of improvements.
The third element is that the defendant, Mr. Schmidt, intentionally used the money for purposes other than the payment of bona fide claims for labor or materials prior to the payment of such claims. What's the prima facie case on that?
That would be established through the answers to interrogatories. Interrogatory number 2, which had asked to identify all the disbursements or payments made which were received from the France Group.
Does that tell us anything about Mr. Schmidt's intent?
I don't think there's anything that would show his intent, but again, the intent would be presumed under 943-20.
That's intent to convert, not this. You're relying entirely on the presumption for the whole sort of panoply of intent issues on this specified contractor under 94320, aren't you?
Well, and it's clear from the cases that the intent that you have to prove is that the intent to use the money other than to pay subcontractors, and clearly no one's going to come in here and say, oh, well, I intended to steal this money and never pay you. No one's going to testify to that fact. So how do you determine the intent? You have to look to the conduct. And that's what the cases provide. You look to the conduct of the defendant, and you look to the presumption here that if they fail and refuse to pay it over to the person who it's due to, you have an intent established.
Right, but don't we usually have trials in front of juries for those sorts of issues? The juries can draw inferences from what the parties did or didn't do, what the parties said or didn't say, and we leave those issues up to juries rather than courts and summary judgments on an issue like intent.
If there was some type of an answer to rebut that presumption, creating some factual issue, then it would be for the jury. But here there was nothing ever stated to rebut that presumption, and the presumption under 94320 stayed and was not challenged.
Is it permissible for a court to draw inferences on an issue like intent on a summary judgment motion?
I think it's proper. It's clearly within the court's realm to determine whether a presumption is granted through a statute and unrebutted by any type of factual evidence. I think that's something that's properly decided on summary judgment, and it would be the defendant's burden to introduce some type of supporting evidence or factual issues to rebut that presumption on summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hansen, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Mr. Hansen, before you begin, I have a question on basic summary judgment law.
Okay.
I've read it so often, but I think that if it can be said that the only reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the facts before the court lead to one result, then summary judgment is correct, is appropriately given.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
It's said far better by other people, but that's my understanding.
I think that it's a statute, says basically that.
Now, when I look at the two, when I'm looking at the issue of whether or not 779 is even applicable, you have raised two issues, one with respect to ownership and one with respect to improvements. And I look at the facts that were before us that are uncontested. And among those uncontested facts are that France had his business at this address, that France ordered this cabling network, that the amount was $27,000, etc. And although I find your argument somewhat appealing, I can't find any other reasonable inference other than that, number one, France was either an owner or a tenant from those facts. And also, I can't discern any other reasonable inference other than that these were improvements to the real estate. Now, can you give me some reasonable alternatives, reasonable inferences that I'm missing?
Sure, Your Honor. The owner, I have to agree with you in part that an owner of land can be a tenant. That can be an ownership of an interest in land. But the term owner is a defined term in the statute, and it is defined as an owner of an interest in land who enters into a contract for the improvement of land. An improvement is also a defined term in the statute. An improvement is something built, made, done, etc., on land to or for its permanent benefit. So there has to be some type of permanent benefit plan. Computer cabling.
Hey, I just finished building a home, and I put in an awful lot of wiring. There's no way I'm ever going to get that wiring out of that house. I mean, it's through tubes, it's, you know, underneath, overneath, et cetera, and it's literally thousands of dollars worth of wiring. To me, there's just no question that that's a permanent improvement.
Right. This is a building. I don't know what the ownership interest was. I assume it's a short-term lease, but frankly, I don't have that information.
Well, let's say on improvement.
There is The work that was done basically is they took a building, it's not a new construction, and there's a drop ceiling in there, and the wires are run across the drop ceiling. The testimony, we had actually filed witness lists in the case, the testimony of my client at trial was, yeah, we go and remove these things all the time. You snip it at one end, you snip it at the other end, you yank the wire out. Why would you leave $17,000 of wire sitting in a building, you know, for instance, if you're only going to be there a couple of years? And in fact, the presumption is that you're not going to leave that kind of thing in the property if you intend to move. If you own the building as a new construction, it might be a little different story, but there's no evidence of that in this case. My client would have testified that he's removed that type of wiring on numerous occasions. Also, you're dealing with computers. Wires that are good this year might not be good next year. Wires that are good next year might not be good the year after that. You're really not talking about, you're talking about a technology that's just changing day to day. And I think they're on Cat 7 now. I think the wire involved in this case was Cat 5.
And at the time, that was the state of the art, as I recall.
Yes, it was.
And okay, so that you've answered my question. I don't know if satisfactorily or not. I'll have to think about it with respect to improvements. But again, now getting back to ownership, why isn't the only reasonable inference that he was a tenant, that France was a tenant here?
I think there is, based on the invoice, there probably is some reasonable inference that he had some type of tenancy interest in this property, that France Group had some type of tenancy interest in this property. But once again, an owner is somebody who has an interest in property. You have to remember the second element of that, too, who enters into a contract for the improvement of land, and with improvement being a defined
term. Are you conceding now the ownership issue?
No, because the ownership is two prongs.
I don't understand.
Okay. Ownership means you have to have an owner of an interest in land. A tenancy can be an interest in land, but that owner has to enter into a contract for the improvement of land in order to be an owner under the definition of owner under the statute.
So that ties right back into improvements, then.
Right. Right.
Because there was an agreement here.
You don't have some type, just not really written, but yeah, there was some type of agreement to sell product.
I'm sorry, I took all of your time. I apologize.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Thank you, Mr. Welsenbach, and for your argument in this case. And this concludes the hearing on 00-3190.